I wasn't expected to ever walk properly again, and I do. Like, actually, one of the main things I was really scared about when I was told I was never going to walk was that I ever never dance again. And the first thing I did after 3 months of intense therapy was go and hit a dance floor just to prove I could. And I still do it on a regular basis.
From the Southern Hemisphere, this is the Bondi Tunes Radio Network with Henry O'Donovan.
If I were to say to you the word cancer, what emotions does that bring up? Cancer is still a taboo subject, and as someone who has stage 4 cancer, it's my duty, I feel, to try and extinguish this taboo. I spoke to Maddie, who also has cancer, and he also lives in Sydney. Now, it's a simple question to ask, what kind of cancer do you have? The answer is far more complicated. This interview will go in two parts. This week, we're going to discuss how he feels about having cancer, and how it changes around your body and your psyche.
It's a rare cancer, and unfortunately, what the disease I have is metastatic adrenocortical carcinoma, which means multiplying adrenal cancer. As I said, you know, I went within the first few days, well, actually within the first 7 days, I went from 2 to 9 tumours. Over the last 2.5 years, I've actually gone up to 15 tumours occurring. Some are active, some are not. They had shut down my adrenal gland quite successfully, and occasionally I would get a new tumour and have radiation on it, but I'm now in a situation where they think the chemo is no longer working, and I've got tumours that have grown in my bone. So we're trying to figure out whether that was something that was just wasn't detected before, or whether it's all new growth. My adrenal gland has reactivated, so that's causing a lot of side effects again, like hot flushes and all of the terrible things that go with this particular disease. Mm. Yeah, and it's just, look, it was the luck of the draw, and I was just unfortunate.
You mentioned it was a rare cancer as well, and that's, there's a lot to be said about that, isn't there? I mean, really, what the doctors don't know, or what is restricted, and finding out this must have been quite difficult for them, in all fairness. When you found out this, how did you immediately react?
Look, I was pretty devastated. I was pretty upset when I was basically told that there was nothing they could do for me, and good luck. The following day, I actually met my radiation oncologist and my actual oncologist, who I didn't even know existed until that point. So we had a few more discussions. That clarified a lot of things for me, but I was in shock. I was in shock for probably the first week. Mm. I did make a mental decision to try and handle the disease and the outcome with some grace and some dignity and a sense of humour, because I realised also that it wasn't just me that was affected by my cancer and my terminal diagnosis, but everybody around me. And yes, I realised that if I behaved badly, it would affect everybody else and just make the whole thing a terrible experience for all involved. And it's something that I didn't want it to be, and I still don't want it to be. And I think for me personally, that's been a very important decision. And I think acceptance, which is something that I did come to acceptance fairly quickly. Really, I had no choice.
Yes.
But, you know, it was foisted upon me. But at the same time, I made peace with it. I'm not afraid of dying. I'm afraid of the way I go out. I think, you know, this, what I now know about this disease and other people I've met through Rare Cancers Australia and other people in the adrenal carcinoma group here in Australia and also online, a lot of people don't last longer than 5 years, but particularly when they're that far along as I was, stage 4, pushing on stage 5. So, and with that many tumours. So, you know, look, every day is a blessing for me, and I try and remind myself of that every moment I can. Sometimes it's not easy. I'm sure you're in the same position. Sometimes you kind of scratch
your head. Yeah. And you know, Maddie, our listeners know that I have stage 4 cancer, and I make it very public. And I admire the way you are reacting to this, because I am generally, naturally, a positive person. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, what's the point in moaning and groaning about this? I mean, you know, really, every day seems like a whole new life to me. I see every day, this is a weird thing, but I see every day as a life. And I didn't, you know, construct this thought mechanism. It just happened. A lot of people ask me, where is your cancer? Now, I find this a difficult thing to answer because it moves, doesn't it, Maddie?
Well, mine's in multiple locations. So
me too.
When I was diagnosed, it was in my spinal cord, pushing onto my, well, I had it in my spine, pushing onto my spinal cord, which is why I did emergency decompression surgery and removed three of my vertebrae because the cancer actually eaten into the vertebrae and bone. But the primary one is actually on my adrenal gland, and that was 15 centimeters by 11 by 8 when I was diagnosed. So quite a large tumor. I also had another one on the, also had the one on my spine on C7, I had one on the opposite side of my throat on the C5, C6. I had a couple in my east lung, one in my kidney, one in my spleen. I've now got it. It's spread into my right hip, so I've got multiple locations that it's getting in the bone. There, I had a couple of other tumors pop up in the lungs, which I've had irradiated as well. I've now got a new tumor in my liver. So for me, it's kind of actually everywhere, but my primary one is on top of my kidney, basically.
Okay. Now, I just want to let our listeners know, we've got a bad line. We're both in the city of Sydney. Go figure. I don't know why this is, but anyway. Now, you know, you talked about, you know, how, well, I'm talking about how people react, because, do you know, I've got people who I've known for 20 years, either on social media or in real life, who, the odd person has just stopped contacting me because they're so scared of this disease. And I'm not offended by this. I'm more concerned about them. Can I ask you how your friends and family reacted and how you told them, or did you tell them gradually, Maddie?
Look, there was probably about 15 people in my inner circle, so they all kind of knew at the same time. And yes, I'm like you, I've got people that have stopped talking to me.
Is that right? I thought I was the only one. I thought there was something wrong with me.
Well, there is, Henry. You know,
oh, yes, of kids. Course, yes.
Something wrong with all of us. But no, it's, I think, one of my friends who was one of my best friends, and that was a really hard pill to swallow, but she just could not cope with the fact that I was always the hardworking, outgoing, strong person in our social group that looked after everybody else's problems. So the fact that all of a sudden I looked like I was dying, and I really was dying. And I looked so sick, and I wasn't in the position to support everybody else and hold them up.
Yes.
She just couldn't cope with it. And unfortunately, our relationship's never been the same. And there's some people that just completely cut me off. And
me too. Time, isn't it bizarre?
Yes.
Or is it? Time, or is it bizarre, you know?
Well, look, I think the inverse sense of what you need at the time, right? So all of a sudden I've got a new group of friends who have only ever known me really, really sick with cancer, and I'm a lot better than what I used to be.
That's really interesting. Know, you've actually got cancer friends who don't have cancer, but they're like your cancer friends because you've formed a new group of people.
And they have loved and supported me and looked after me through this whole thing better than some of the people I've known for 20 and 30 years.
Isn't it bizarre? Yeah.
It is, but you know what you lose on the swing, you pick up on the round. And I think it's important not to hold on to what you've lost, but to look at what you've gained, which is what I try and remind myself of. And I feel very blessed that I have those people in my life that are here to support me, help me through day to day, to love and care about me and actually love and support my decisions.
You, obviously, I'm guessing that you were working at some point.
I was working full time. I was working between 50 and 90 hours a week when I was diagnosed. And
oh my God, what were you doing?
I was VM for a massive retail company here. I looked after 3,500 square meters of store on my own, plus I was retail manager for the franchise department.
And that's a big job. So
it was a huge job. It was a job that should have been done by several people, not one. But unfortunately, with the company I was working for, I never had enough money in the budget for anything.
Yeah. We always hear this.
Yeah, and you know, always get blood out of a stone and then a bit more. Yeah. So yeah, for me, I literally went from having an extremely active job to all of a sudden becoming a paraplegic, and then 4 days prior to surgery, I became a quadriplegic, which was absolutely horrific.
You talk in the perfect sense when you say this. Does this suggest that you've gone the other direction now, that you're more active and able to do stuff now?
Definitely, yeah. Look, most people wouldn't know I had cancer unless I told them now, Henry.
That's amazing.
I do physio twice a week. I still do. I've been doing that for 2 years now. I wasn't expected to ever walk properly again, and I do. One of the main things I was really scared about when I was told I was never going to walk was that I ever never dance again. And the first thing I did after 3 months of intense therapy was go and hit a dance floor just to prove I could. And I still do it on a regular basis. It's something that I've worked really hard at, and I continue to work hard at. I have an amazing physiotherapist. I've got an amazing GP. I've got an amazing medical team behind me as well. So I haven't just done it on my own. But yeah, look, I've had a lot of love, help and support from a lot of people. But yes, inevitably the buck comes down to
it's up to you. In the end, it's up to you. No, and it's lovely that people are supporting you. You know, you sort of had to stop working, and you know what I found, and you noticed this today because I was late coming to this interview. Having cancer makes you very busy, Matty. It makes you very busy.
Yeah, look, how did we ever fit in work and a life?
I know. Now, do you socialise still, and do you socialise in a different way, or do you tend not to socialise? I find I'm getting, and by the way, if you've just joined us, I'm talking with Maddie, we both have cancer, by the way. I get people to come over to my place. I do go out. But I find it's better if they come over to my place, because you know, for our listeners, when you have cancer, it has a lot to do with a lot of things, including your toilet habits, because you can get constipation from chemo, and you can get diarrhea from chemo, and you have to be really careful. And I'm just being honest about this. Maddie, thoughts?
Yeah, look, I also have problems because my primary tumor is so large, and where it sits, which is on top of my adrenal gland and kidney, it actually dislodged my bowel, my spleen, my kidney. It's dislodged most of the vital organs in my stomach. So I kind of look like I'm at least 6 months pregnant most of the time. and it pushes onto my bladder. So I'm like, you know, I've had the diarrhea, I've had the constipation, and they come in swings and roundabouts. I take about 45 tablets a day, Henry, just to keep me up and mobile.
Sorry, say that to our listeners again.
I take about 45 tablets a day on this day, sometimes 47.
Oh, how do you do this? Like, how many tablets do you take at a time?
Look, when it first started, I used to try and take the whole handful. Actually, it's several handfuls. And then I had a problem where, because I'd had radiation on my throat, both for the surgery on my spine and the tumor on the other side of my throat, and they burnt my vocal cords when they did the radiation. So then I had swallowing, so then I had to have thickened juices and jellies and things in order to swallow. So that was really difficult. And now I'm back at the stage where my body has balanced out how I swallow, because of course of the shunts in my neck, it pushes my head forward. And I also had surgery on my throat when I was 27 and had half my tongue and the left side of my throat removed, so that also affected the way I swallow.
And sorry, this is before cancer that you had that happen to you?
That's right. Yeah, oh, I was 50 when I was diagnosed. It was 27 when I had the throat issue, which they thought was cancer but wasn't. But I had already signed a consent to operate and consent to remove anything they thought looked sus, and so they basically went to town on me at the time.
So
in order of swallowing, I usually do about 3 to 4 handfuls of tablets, because some of them are tiny, some of them are large. I also have a mixture of vitamins in that. I also take a couple of tonics. There's also external testosterone and things that are put into that mix on top of the tablets. But yeah, I try and swallow it in about 3 mouthfuls if I can. I usually do it with elixir of apple cider or a honey cider, which is good for your gut bacteria, because obviously when you're taking this many medications, things get messed up. And that's something that a lot of listeners might not be aware of, but for every 3 or 4 medications you have when you have cancer, there's interactions and side effects, which usually lead to taking more medications, which have in my circumstances, which also leads to more interactions and more side effects and more medications. So the list got bigger and bigger. And into pre-diabetes, it caused my cholesterol to go from 3.9 to 9.9, which I'm kind of proud of. it was quite a fun mission to get there. So there's lots of other things you just don't realize, but every time you do something with your body, it kind of throws the balance out, and then it tries to recalibrate. And sometimes you need medications to do that. Sometimes you need your body to do that.
Yeah, it's a bit like medication upon medication.
From Sydney, Australia, Henry O'Donovan on Bondi Tunes International.
I was in hospital today, as you know, and a nutritionist came to see me, and we talked about food, and it was the most interesting conversation. I seem to be doing the right thing, but I want to ask you, what you eat. The same question she asked me. What do you have for breakfast, lunch, and dinner? What is in your diet?
Medication, followed by.
Hopefully there's some Weet-Bix in there somewhere.
No, so all seriousness for me, I've also seen a nutritionist a couple of times, because one of the side effects of this illness was that it gave me hyperkalemia, which is actually an overabundance of potassium in your diet, which was hospitalizing me. So every food you eat contains potassium. There are some things super high in potassium, so I was doing the right thing, what I thought. I was juicing every morning and putting all the good stuff in, and I didn't realize I was actually poisoning myself and ending up in hospital once a month. So I actually had to change my diet, because I take about 35 tablets in the morning. It depends on the day of the week. Some days I have more than others. Because I take that many tablets, I don't usually eat breakfast. My system's used to doing it on an empty stomach. And after you swallow that many tablets, you kind of feel full. It's kind of like you've had a meal. So I usually don't eat on most days before about 1 o'clock. And then I usually have a light lunch, or I'll have a heavy lunch, and then at night I only have snacks or a medium meal. Although I'm on a routine where I tend to actually only eat once a day, but when I eat as much as I want, however long I want. And it's basically like a 12 hour intermittent fasting, which kind of puts your body into ketosis, which is meant to be good for people with cancer.
Yes, so I've heard that it's actually good for people generally to do this 12 hours of no eating. I've got a friend who swears by it.
Yeah, look, I actually have just as much, if not more, energy than I normally would if I ate all day. And by the time I get to eat, because I usually eat probably around 5 or 6 p.m., by the time I get to that stage, yeah, I'm hungry, but I also don't eat as much as I would have if I'd eaten all day.
Do you find it difficult to eat? I mean, one thing, I haven't told you this all fair, but I've just come off chemo. I've just been told I've I can go off chemo for a while. But I found, thank you. I found that whilst on chemo that I was losing my appetite. And as you know, losing weight is a very dangerous thing if you've got cancer. So, you know, I just tend to think I'm beginning to eat again, which is great. But do you have that problem where you feel nauseous when you eat?
Okay, so when I was first diagnosed, I was put on a really intensive liquid chemo as well as the chemo medication that I'm constantly on and have been since the day I was diagnosed. So when I was on the liquid chemo or chemo infusions, I got so sick that I'd walk out of there and I'd vomit in the street. I couldn't eat. I think I was hungry and I'd be desperate to eat, and I would go somewhere and order a meal, and I had carers that would take me out for the day because I couldn't go out on my own because I wasn't stable. And basically, I would order a meal and then I would actually have to not only send it back to the kitchen uneaten, but explain to them there was nothing wrong with the meal. It was because I had cancer and I couldn't eat it. The novelty wears off after a while. So I was living on about one meal a day if I could stomach anything. And I lost 29 kilo. Over the course of six and a half months.
20 kilos?
29 kilos, so nearly 30 kilos.
And what do you normally weigh?
So I was about 79 kilo, and I went down to 50.
I've got a friend who is Australian. She lives in Germany, and she said a couple of things that I found rather amusing. First of all, she lost weight, and she loved that. She suddenly, you know, she wasn't overweight, but she wanted to lose weight, and this was a good damn way to lose weight, get cancer. And the other thing she said, and you might find this interesting or funny, she said, look, if you've got cancer, you can get anything you want. If you've got a problem, if anyone's got a problem with you, just say, I've got cancer. If you get on a bus and you don't have your fare or something, not that that would happen for most people, but, you know, you just say, well, I've got cancer. And people are frightened of this and they just leave you alone. They let you, you know, we don't take advantage of this, neither myself or Felicity.
I do.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear it.
When I was first diagnosed, Henry, I made terrible jokes about it. So we used to, when I'd walk into a room, I'd call out dead man walking.
Yes.
Because, you know, I was meant to be dead. So, you know, there was the dead man walking jokes, and they're a pretty fly for a dead guy, which I think they
are. Oh, yeah.
But, you know, one of the best ones was I was with two of my best friends, their husband and wife, and we were having a night at their place, and we'd had a few drinks, and yes, I you know, actually had a couple of drinks, I got cancer. And we were talking anyway. I had said something to set this particular girlfriend of mine up, and her partner and I were laughing at her, and she went, right, that's it, you're both dead to me. And I looked at her the greatest possible face, and I said, honey, that's a really terrible thing to say to someone that's dying.
Guilt complex.
She started, you know, crying, getting all upset, and Scott and I were on the floor laughing because, you know, like I was obviously sending her up.
Yes.
Unfortunately, she thought I was serious. But, you know, it's one of those things, you kind of have to have a sense of humor about it.
You are not hidden. There's never been a moment you were forgotten. You are not hopeless. Though you have been broken, your innocence stolen. I hear you whisper underneath your breath. I hear your SOS, your SOS. I will send out an army to find you in the middle of the darkest night. It's true, I will rescue you. there is no distance that cannot be covered over and over. You're not defenseless. I'll be your shelter, I'll be your armor. I hear you whisper underneath your breath. I hear your SOS, your SOS. I will send out an army to find you.
If you've just joined us, I'm Henry for Bondi Tunes International in Sydney, Australia. I'm joined by Maddie, who is also in Sydney, in the city. We've got sound issues with our recording software, so please bear with us. Maddie, you live alone, is that right?
Yeah, I do. I live in a small studio apartment.
You're able to cope with living alone? And like, I've got a partner here who I'm taking full advantage of. No, but she's fantastic, you know. Do you find it difficult to do certain things, you know, like having a shower? I mean, these are things we take for granted. And dear listener, you will understand this. It's a whole new ball game. And if you've got cancer, you're listening out there and you've got cancer, you know what we're talking about. Little things like having a shower, just, you know, getting around the house, cooking, that kind of thing. I believe you cooked on Christmas Day.
Yeah, I was at Mum's and I did some cooking for her, yeah.
You did all the work.
Well, I did, because my mum's 89, so...
Oh, okay.
Thank you for telling anyone. We'll just keep that one quiet.
We won't tell her.
Yeah, so look, it's I'm a lot better than I was when I was diagnosed. So when I first came home, I just had spinal surgery. I live up 48 stairs to get to my apartment. So
I
was in a walking frame, I very quickly learned how to walk on a walking stick and how to actually walk unaccompanied because I had no choice. I did, when I first got diagnosed, I did a packed meals for about 6 months because I couldn't handle, with the chemo and everything, I just couldn't handle cooking, I couldn't handle shopping, I couldn't handle a lot of things. Mm. I did have carers that helped me several times a week, which was a blessing, and I was really fortunate that I was in that position, that I could have help.
Yes.
Living on my own most of the time is great because if I want to sit, because I'm having a hot flush and I want to sit around in my underwear and scratch the hairs on my back, I can. No one's offended.
Yes, that's a good point. Yeah, Very good point.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of things I can do that because I don't live with somebody else. Look, I still get a carer in once a week to help me with vacuuming and doing some of the hard cleaning because I have problems with bending and pushing a vacuum cleaner, for example, because of the rods in my spine. So there are some things I can't do anymore. So I get help with that. And that's okay because I'm in the position where, yes, I've got help and I've got the access to help. And B, I learned very, very, very quickly when I was diagnosed that it's okay to ask for help. It's okay not to be able to do everything on your own. It's okay not to have all the answers. And it's okay to lean on people, which I never thought I was never comfortable with.
Yeah, you know what, Maddie? I totally understand that because I'm what they call an alpha male. I've run this radio show for 15, 16 years, and I'm used to being in control of everything that I do. And I found that having cancer, I sort of felt that I couldn't ask people because I'm, as you mentioned earlier on, you were in a position, a powerful, well, an important position. I don't know if it's powerful or not, but you had people depending on you. And all of a sudden you think, at least I thought, I can't really ask people to help me. I'm not used to this. It took some getting used to, but you really have to just do it, you know?
You do. It's when you're a fiercely independent person, which I always have been, and I assume you are as well, Henry, I think it's really, really, really hard to ask for help. It's almost like giving up part of your pride. And, you know, when I had my operation and I was, because I was in hospital for 3.5 months.
Whoa.
You know, I basically had to have people shower me because I couldn't wash myself or because I had defecated in bed because, I had to have things because I was so constipated that I didn't go to the toilet for 6 days. So,
yeah. So there's a lot of humility in that, isn't there? You know, just needing that help. Yeah.
Yeah, it really, like being in hospital crushed me for that long. It really stripped all dignity.
Was that earlier on in the piece, Maddie?
Yeah, that was from when I was diagnosed till when I got out 3 months later. I did 3 weeks of rehab, which was crap.
Is that right?
Yeah, I thought it was going to be the answer to my prayers and so much better than being in hospital, and it actually was the opposite. And I had the guy that was in charge of my case, who happened to be the head of rehabilitation center. I won't mention names, but sure. He was an absolute prat, and he just told me all of these things without actually having a conversation with me, and then got very upset with me when I explained to him that what he was telling me was a load of rubbish. And you know, he basically, we had one conversation where he basically told me that, oh, well, you know, I suppose if you just want to lay in bed and feel sorry for yourself and never work again, I suppose I can sign off on that. And it's like, hang on, I've been told by 3 spinal surgeons, my oncologist, my radiation oncologist, now that I've had all of this surgery and I'm having all this ongoing treatment, I'll never ever be able to do my career again. Not because I don't want to, but because unfortunately I can't bend, twist, do all the things that I used to be able to do. I can't lift heavy weights anymore. You know, I went from lifting 35, 40 kilos to barely being able to lift a coffee cup. So, and it was kind of like, well, you know, here was this guy telling me all of the things that I obviously didn't want to do. And it was not that I didn't want to do them. I was meant to do physio once a day. When I was in hospital, I used to do physio 4 times a day. 3 times of the day, I used to get on my frame and I would walk around the ward. I would do the exercises I was allowed to do unassisted. And I did that every day I was in hospital before I went to rehab. So obviously, it wasn't that I didn't want to try. It wasn't that I didn't want to walk again. It wasn't that I didn't want to be able to do those things. But I was being told that I obviously didn't. I'd given up and I didn't care. And that's really hard, I think.
It is, especially in your condition. Now, look, I have 3 oncologists in St. Vincent's Hospital in Sydney looking after me, and they truly are very good. But I would like to point out to our listeners, and if you've got cancer and you're listening out there, you probably will understand this. Doctors can be very arrogant, and I mean that in the nicest possible way. Because when you think about it, the patient is the one who's is the weaker person in that relationship, obviously. Doctors can be very arrogant and just tell you rather than ask you. And I don't take any of that crap from doctors, and I didn't have to. And, you know, I just think you have to sort of defend yourself almost with some doctors, because they can just plow right over you and tell you what to do. And I think you had a bit of that going on with that guy, you know?
You learn very, very quickly once you're diagnosed with cancer and you're in the worst possible, most vulnerable state, that you have to be an advocate for yourself. So you're in the worst possible position to advocate for yourself. Because nobody, especially with rare cancer, nobody knows what the hell to do with you, let alone yourself.
Yes.
Obviously, you're reliant on the medical profession to give you a way forward. But you're in a situation where you've got all of these people that are arrogant. They, you know, think they're gods. They talk down to you like you're the village idiot. The best example.
Well, that's right. Yes.
When I was in hospital, because I had so many cancers, every cancer in every organ and every position was owned by a different department. So
yeah, and so, that gets messy. Let's face it, that gets really messy.
Especially when you've got the on-call doctor who's your physician and the other 12 practicing ones that they drag around with them just pop in at random intervals. So you might have 70 or 80 or 90 people you're dealing with in a day when your head's really literally spinning anyway from everything that's going on and the medications and the drugs. And I learned very quickly that I had to be my advocate. And how I learned that was, so I remember not long after I was diagnosed, I had a group of, I think they were the endocrinologists, and they really thought they were God. And they walked in and basically said, oh, well, you know, we don't want to answer any of your questions right now. How about you take a pen and paper and you write down all the questions you think are important, and then you can ask the appropriate doctors.
So you know,
you're allowed to laugh, and please interrupt and go on.
Now, I just wanted to mention, you know, the doctors are a bit scared of me because I'm a journalist and they know it. And my girlfriend, who is, you know, my partner, she comes in with me and she asks a lot of questions too because she's a writer. So they get a bit of afraid of us, actually, because we just absolutely pummel them with questions. And they're not used to this. They're used, as we said earlier on, they're used to the patient being the quiet one who just is told what to do and does what they're told. That doesn't happen with us, and the doctors damn well know it. And it's not that we're on the defense. We're just protecting our rights, and also making sure that they know that they can't just, you know, order us to do things without us questioning what they're ordering us to do.
Yeah, so look, that brings me to this story I was telling you. So basically, I was a really good boy. I wrote down all my questions, and I thought about it over several days, and I wrote down all the things that were important to me. And I went through all the plan A to plan B, because I'm somebody that likes to make a plan of, well, if the street gets flooded, what do I do? You know, I'm one of those practical people. It's not half empty, it's not half full, the glass is just half. Realist. So,
oh yes, me too. I totally agree with that. Yes,
really fantastic questions, and they were like really bloody important questions. And so I, you know, I said to about three lots of different teams, because as I said, they all come in tandem.
Yes,
and I said, look, so I've got this question. That's a really great question. You've obviously put a lot of thought into it, and these are the three answers. I choose not to answer that question. B, that's a hypothetical, so I couldn't possibly answer that question. Or, that's an interesting question. next question. never said answer.
It's called not answering the question. Well, okay, now we've knocked the hell out of doctors, but I would like to say that there's fantastic doctors out there and oncologists. I've experienced that, and I am continuing to experience that. And if you've just joined us, I'm talking with Maddie. Here in Sydney, we both live in apartment blocks, so it's noisy and we have a connection problem. But please bear with us, okay? Now, I just want to say, Maddie, you obviously have been on chemo. I don't know if you are at the moment, are you?
chemo tablets every day of my life, but basically because of the latest outbreak of the disease in elsewhere in my body, the question is whether the chemo tablets are no longer working. And so we're looking at doing a different treatment, but that's been on pause for 3 months so I could have another PET scan so I can try and decide whether not only the reactivation of my adrenal gland, which is causing other tumors to grow, but whether how rapidly that's grown. It grew 1 centimeter wide by 9 centimeters long in 3 months, which is actually
Whoa.
quite sizable. And now we've discovered the one in the bone. So what the question is was the one in the bone always there, but it only showed up on PET scans, which I should have been having, and I kept asking to have, but I was told I didn't need because my gland wasn't active. In hindsight, I should have fought harder. So now we're doing this backtrack of trying to figure out, is it that the chemo tablets are no longer working? If that's the case, with my particular disease, there are very limited options. So they are talking about immune therapy, which is $24,000 out of pocket, and
Yes.
has a less than 10% chance of working with my particular disease.
You're good.
Different forms of chemo, different stages of chemo treatment, yes and no. So it's when I was first diagnosed, and in that period where I was not expected to actually survive through chemo infusions, and got really sick, and I had brain fog, and I could barely function, and I was constantly tired, and all of those things. As it's progressed, because I'm still on, I'm on a very high dose of a drug called Miotane, and I'm on 8 tablets a day. Most people on average take 2 to 3, so I'm on a very high dose of this particular drug. And it's one of those things. My body has now compensated. So, look, obviously my body has compensated and is used to pushing through. So the fact that I probably had this cancer for 8 years before it was diagnosed proves that I can push through, and I have a high tolerance, and my body finds ways to adapt. So I have managed to come back to those levels, and finally the brain fog's cleared. And yes, there are days where I have spurts, and I could probably walk up to the top of the Sydney Harbour Bridge and back. Then there's a days where there are days where, I'd be hard pushed to walk to the corner.
I find it funny. They always say it's different for everyone. Myself and girlfriend have a joke about this. Oh yeah, it's different for everyone. That's what they keep saying, and they're right, and you're right. I just want to mention that the King of England has cancer, right? And I noticed in a BBC report that they very quickly say that ten. Sorry, let me get this right. 10, there's a population of 55 million people in Britain. 10 million people have cancer. Now, I spoke to a nurse today in the hospital, and she said, that's very grey, because cancer is there's different levels of cancer, different types of cancer, but it's still remarkable that 10 million out of 55 million, I think, the population has cancer. What are your thoughts on that? Like, is cancer growing? I excuse the pun, but is cancer growing amongst people?
Quite literally, yes. And it's really interesting there. I was actually having a conversation with medical professionals, and also to Rare Cancers Australia, who are a really wonderful support group that I have here in Australia. And rare cancers are growing exponentially. So we're the least funded, but we actually make up 30% of all fatalities from cancer. And Medicare, which you were mentioning before, so things like PET scans aren't covered if you have rare cancer, but they are if you have normal cancer. So there's all of these different things, but cancer itself now actually affects one in five, saying it will eventually affect one in three.
This is an amazing figure you just mentioned, that an amazing stats that have been projected, let's say, forecast. Now, you mentioned that, you know, you have been involved in the media. I mentioned some of those organizations that you've been involved with over the last however long. Tell me about a little bit about them, and have you helped them, and have they helped you, and who are they?
Yeah, so when I was first diagnosed, I went through Cancer Council Australia. And I used to do their support group, but because I had rare cancer and no one knew what my disease was or what to do with me, they put me in stage fours, and it was a bit like God's waiting room.
Tell me about it.
There's a whole heap of older people all going, oh, there's nothing else I can do, and blah, 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 and I've had all the treatments.
I'm surrounded by the old people, I know, yes.
Yeah, so look, I mean, that was probably, for a while it worked for me, but then it really stopped working. But I became part of a group called Rare Cancers Australia, and they actually have outfits all around the world, and they specialize in rare cancers. So they have been extremely supportive to me. There's the general group, so everybody in it has a different cancer, but we all have rare cancer. So that's the one thing that actually ties us together. And because rare cancer, you face different obstacles to general cancer. Because, you know, it's not like breast cancer or testicular cancer or lung cancer, where everybody knows what it is and knows how to treat it. And there are forms of treatment that are really successful and others that aren't. When you've got a rare cancer, nothing seems to be very successful because nobody knows what's going to work with it, because they've never
come across. It's unknown territory, basically, isn't it?
A very unknown territory. In fact, when I was first diagnosed and I was given this five-page document from a place in America, and not only did it say I was going to be dead in 3 months, but it also explained in it that anyone that's ever treated a patient with my particular cancer, whether they lived or died, whether they were dead within a week or lasted, you know, 5 years or whatever, that particular oncologist was considered a specialist in the field because this disease is so rare. So, you know, you've got a doctor that's treated one person with it, they might have killed them in 3 weeks' time, but that's okay, they're a specialist. And with rare cancers, they are really supportive on things like that. They have actually come up now and started a group for adrenocortical carcinoma, because they have enough people that have actually got the disease that we actually have our own meeting once a month, which is really helpful when you're talking to other people with what works, what doesn't work. Yes. When with an actual disease. But they've also given me opportunities. So I spoke with the Australian Federal Health Board probably about 9-10 months after I was diagnosed, to speak about pitfalls and things that happened, and to put in a person with active cancer's perspective of how we're treated by the health system in Australia. That was amazing to have that opportunity. I was also sent to...
Maddie, what did you actually have to do? Did you have to go up and talk about this?
Yes, I did. So,
You know, it's funny, I'm a broadcaster, but it frightens the shit out of me if I have to go, stand in front of a microphone in front of even 100 people. It freaks me out completely. Public speaking seems to be your friend.
Look, I did Toastmasters when I was a teenager, so that has hit me, you know, in all fairness. And also, too, because of my job, I had to speak to people all the time. Yeah. And I've been in retail for over 35 years, so I'm fairly confident at speaking to people. When I'm public speaking, yes, I do get nervous, but I've learned to, you know, concentrate on my breathing, take a step back, take a beat. If I need to slow my speech down and basically just be authentic. And I think that's the most important thing I've done.
Believable.
Well, just be totally honest,
real.
And you know, say it how it is. Occasionally I drop the swear word in, even if I'm public speaking, because you know what, the average person...
Real.
will say a cuss word. And, you know, at the end of the day, if you get offended, well, I'm really sorry about that. But you're asking me to tell you what my journey's been, and that's another word I absolutely loathe, is journey.
Oh, look, let's not get started on that one.
yeah, there's so many terminologies with cancer that when you diagnose, you're all of a sudden meant to believe in whatever
journey.
Journey. I mean, I'm not on a trip to India, mate. It's
Here's another thing, Maddie. You know, people, you know, over this, I only got diagnosed 6 months ago, and like you, it's been years. But it's funny, people go, they come over to my place and we have social function. They go, "You look great." And I find this hilarious. I'm going, yeah. And I actually got a tan. I don't normally get a tan, but I thought I'm going to play on this. So I got a tan and I do look great. And I was at a Christmas Day party, and someone said to me, "You look great." And I said, "Well, look, the reason I look great is because when you have cancer and you go to a function or people meet you, they think that you have to look awful. So I went to a lot of trouble to look great. Thank you very much."
As I always say, Henry, it takes me a lot of effort to look this plain.
Yeah, you've got a lot of self-confidence, I'll give you that. Now, you mentioned, Medicare. Okay, just to our international audience in Britain who have the NHS, which, by the way, people keep crapping on about. People say it's terrible. I thought it was good. But not to worry. Let's compare to America. Now, Maddie, if you and I lived in America, this would be a different scenario.
If I was in America with this answer, I would
You'd
be dead by now.
I know you were going to say that. So would I.
I couldn't afford all the scans. I couldn't actually afford to go and see a GP. I would be well and truly out the river without a paddle.
Aren't we lucky? I mean, we can moan and groan about doctors and that kind of thing. But the truth is, Medicare in Australia is amongst, if not the best in the world. I believe in India, it's very good as well. But really, we are lucky, aren't we? I mean, imagine living in America. If your credit card, doesn't work, you don't get help. It's really as vicious and simple as that.
Look, Henry, when I was put into hospital, I had used all my sick days because I'd been having these problems with my back, thinking it was like I'd thrown my back out. So I had time off, and I'd used all my sick days, and I'd used all my holiday accruement. So, I mean, I was in a situation where I was absolutely up the river without a paddle. You know, not only did I overnight lose my career, but lost my ability to work, let alone walk.
Yes.
Financially, I was in dire straits. It took several months, you know, for insurance to come through. I was financially in trouble, and if it hadn't been for Medicare, I mean, if I'd been in another country, I wouldn't have been treated. I'd have been turfed out, and I really would be dead by now. So, like, I count my blessings every day that I was born in Australia and that I, you know, have the access to. Yes, there's always room for improvement. There's always someone that's going to complain.
Of course,
but considering how dire it could be, I think we're very lucky. I think faith is a wonderful thing, and I think faith, you know,
it's good for the soul. Good for the soul.
Whatever you believe, whether it's God or Allah or Buddha or the spirit of the door or the master of the tree or the energy that runs between all of us, I think it's great to have that to have a conversation with. And if you want to pray, I've seen miracles happen with prayer, so I think that's wonderful. I think faith itself is a great thing. I just think the organized chaos of religions and things taints it and makes it something that it shouldn't be.
Yeah. You know, I've studied this for 30 years, and I've written about it for 30 years. I'm a spiritualist, very similar to yourself. I don't believe in conventional religion. It's only 2,000 years old. I'm more into shamanism, which is, you know, much more than 2,000 years old. We're talking 25,000 years old. And it's not to do with the age of things, but I do believe that, you know, religion, conventional religion, Judaism, Protestantism, or which is what I am, even though I can't pronounce it, or Catholicism, I believe they are new religions, and they were designed to control the masses, quite frankly. I don't want to get too much into that, but
it's the trouble.
Yeah, the thing is, you know, we have the same view. It's an important question to ask because we don't know when we're going to die, and it could be a lot sooner than a lot of other people. So do you feel comfortable in yourself, where you're at the moment? And do you, you mentioned earlier on in our broadcast that, you know, you know that you could die in 6 months or whatever. Do you, obviously, you're a very rational person. You don't have false hope. You're a realist like myself. And I am a realist, and it frightens the hell out of some people because I am a realist. I'm not just one of these people go, oh, I'm really feeling positive, I must get better. I'm not that kind of person. Do you feel positive, though, in yourself? And does it matter? I mean, my concern is other people if I die, not me. I understand. I believe in reincarnation. I'm all across that, you know.
100% behind you on that one, Henry. You know, when I'm dead, I'm dead. I won't remember it. And even if I do, I won't be here to talk about it. What happens whether I go to heaven or hell, or, well, if I go to hell, there'll be a dance party with all my mates. But
indeed.
You know, the bottom line is, you know, I don't know whether I'm reborn and reincarnated, what happens afterwards, but I do know that I probably won't remember it. So the only life I have to live is the one I've got. And that every day is a blessing. I take it as I can, and I'm not the one that's going to be left behind with the grief and
exactly
the upset. It's the people around me that it concerns me about. One thing, euthanasia is now legal in New South Wales.
That's an important point, yes.
If I got to a really terrible place where I could no longer wash myself or clean myself or get to a bathroom or do the things that are important to me, then that's an option for me. And there again, you know, obviously there's a lot of religious belief around it, and some people won't agree with that conversation. But I think as long as you do the right thing with the right intentions for the right reasons, then that's the best thing you can do. You know, I don't have any, it's not that I want to check out tomorrow or that I want to commit suicide because I've had enough of life and I'm over it.
No.
I'm very thankful for everything I've got. But if it ends tomorrow, well, it ends tomorrow, because there's two things that are guaranteed in this life. You come into it and you go out of it. Everything else in between, that, you know, that's sort of on the fly, but they're the one, two things that we know is there's a start and there's an end.
Yes.
When that end's going to happen, none of us know. We could all get hit by buses tomorrow. So somebody could start a nuclear war and wipe out the earth tomorrow. Like, none of us know what's going to come around that corner.
Yeah.
So especially with the state that the world's in at the moment. So I'm very comfortable with, if I, you know, the most important thing for me is that I don't have a long, protracted, terrible death. That would be like death by 1,000 paper cuts.
Yeah.
And I can say that because I already had 3.5 months of experiencing what that would be like. So I already know the writings.
You had a sneaky peek to that, didn't you?
I did, and it scared the crap out of me, to be honest.
Yeah, of course. Expression. As it would.
It was the most humiliating, undignified, soulless experience I've ever had in my life, and I've had a few. It really did. It made me think, yeah, I don't want to be here. And that's not who I am. I'm very appreciative to be here, and I'm so appreciative.
And you love life. You clearly love life.
I do love life. And, you know, I have a great social life. I have friends that I catch up with several times a week. I have people that I talk to all the time on the phone, people, you know, overseas who, you know, friends of mine for 30, 35 years that we regularly do Facebook and FaceTime and Skype and all of those things to keep in contact. You know, I'm really lucky. I have a good life. And if I want to go out, you know, I go out once every 3 months with a couple of friends, and we go out to a bar and, you know, to a dance club. So all of the things I never thought I'd do again, by the way.
Yeah,
so,
you're going out to dance clubs. Come on, this is
fantastic. I'm really blessed, you know.
Yes,
so I'm very much alive, but at the same time, if I cark it tomorrow, well, that's the way it is, right?
Yeah. Look, we're way over time. Maddie, thank you for being so candid in this interview, and I wish you the best, and you wish me the best, don't you?
I definitely do, Henry. I hope that, everything actually works out. I'm glad that you're in there for a while.
I'm going to have a beer with you someday. Could we already live down the road from each other? You're in near King's Cross in Sydney and I'm in Bondi. Maddie, thank you so much for joining us here on Bondi Tunes International.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, and I hope that it's been enlightening.
It has indeed. This is Bondi Tunes International. This is Real Radio. And we will continue this conversation about cancer next week. Thanks for joining us.
Bondi Tunes International. Across your world.
The sun never sets on Bondi Tunes.